Welcome, everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo, the show where I get to hang out with my very good friends every week right here on the podcast, and those would be John Lindemann.
Johnny, it's a pleasure to be here once again.
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
That never changes. And James Jones.
Hi.
So Greg reminded us, thankfully, right before we started recording, that this episode indeed marks the fourth anniversary of us four doing this show together. And I'm frankly amazed that all four of us are still here. And we're not going to do a big special thing or anything like that. We've got a normal show with new business and listener mail planned for you. But just wanted to make note of it and say that I wouldn't want to be anywhere else at this very moment than right here doing this with you guys. It's my favorite part of the week. And I think what we have done is very special. So thanks, everybody, for listening, especially those of you who've been with us for that long. And I hope we get to keep doing it for a while yet.
Four more years. Four more years.
Well, you know, I don't know, Johnny. We live pretty high-risk lifestyles, I think, the whole podcast.
I do. I don't know about you guys.
Well, I mean, if you stopped gambling with the Russian mafia, it wouldn't be a problem, would it?
They're Latvian. Latvian mafia.
All right. Well, anyway, we are going to jump into the show. We'll have a retroactive winner announcement for you a little bit later. But as of this very moment, the poll has not quite closed, and it's so close, I can't call it. So we will. You definitely want to stick around to the end of the episode if you haven't already found out via Twitter or Facebook what the winner was. But anyway, we're going to start off with new business, and John is up first.
I've been playing a game called Terraria. So a friend of mine, actually, he's been trying to get me to play this with him because you can play with, you know, two players at once. And supposedly it's a 2D version. Bear in mind, I've never played Minecraft. Let me throw that out there. But supposedly it's a 2D version of that, which is kind of like a sandbox game, 2D platformer. So you can create stuff. You can, you know, if you want to go down into a cave, well, it's dark in the cave, but you can chop down some wood and create a torch, do stuff like that. And so finally, so I was like, all right, I'll buy it on Steam. I'll buy it on Steam when I see it cheap. Well, I don't really keep track of Steam very well, so he happened to see it on there for $2 over the holidays. So he just bought it. So one day I just get like a gift on Steam, and he's like, I just bought it for you, man, because I knew you were never going to buy it yourself. So
I came really close to buying it because it's been on my watch list for quite a while. And I came really close, but I just bought all these other freaking games, and I was like, I can't do it, you know. But I mean, I do have Minecraft, and this to me looks and sounds a lot more fun than Minecraft. It's more gamey. It's more. I mean, John, have you ever played Spelunker?
Yes, I've played Spelunker.
Like the old ass NES game. It probably started on Intellivision or something like that, but it reminds me a lot of that game, just in the way it looks, at least.
Yeah, I mean, so because you can chop down trees and, like I said, create stuff out of them. You can create chairs and tables and stuff, and you can build a house, apparently. And apparently there are actual bosses that you can find. Mm-hmm. You can't beat them by yourself. You have to play with somebody else, and I guess you can cooperate to beat the bosses. Hmm. We, of course, haven't even remotely got that far. We just kind of messed around, and what I was doing, you know, we were just kind of, because, I mean, I'm completely new to the game, so we're digging through some caves and stuff, and, you know, I would put down a torch, and I would see a water deposit up off a little ways, and so I would dig into it, and of course the water would flow down at that point, and of course I'd put my torch down on the floor, so it would put my torch out and everything was black and I wouldn't know what the hell I was doing. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that where you can screw up what you're doing or what somebody else is doing completely by accident without even just realizing kind of what will happen when you, if you do this over here, the kind of the cause and effect chain. But
does playing it feel kind of like a 2D platformer even with all these other mechanics going on?
Yeah, it's definitely a 2D platformer, but it's a little bit chaotic because you can, with the other person there, you can kind of get, because you don't always see them on your screen. So you may not know what the heck they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's not really like, I mean, you can cooperate, but then you can also kind of screw yourself over at the same time. But it definitely is a 2D platformer, absolutely.
Yeah, that's kind of why it appeals to me more than Minecraft, because I think as a first-person game, Minecraft is fairly inept. I mean, it's kind of slow-moving and you can jump, but the platforming just doesn't seem to be very good. And to me, I mean, the mechanics of being able to get these materials and build equipment and dig down into the caves and fight the monsters and explore, that's all really more appealing in a 2D game for me, especially with the bright, colorful graphics that Terraria has. So,
yep,
people have been recommending this to me for a long time, and I am a little afraid of just how expansive it seems to be, but it just looks more immediately fun than Minecraft.
Well, each time you create a world and then save it, and it just creates a world randomly. So you'll get something different every time you play it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're gonna play it a bit more once we get a little bit of time set aside, and you know we're gonna see what else we can do in it, because I mean he's played it quite a bit, so he knows a lot more about it than I do. But yeah, it has the same kind of element where it has the time element, like night and day, where you know the monsters come out at night. So you have to kind of watch out for that. You have to, you know, build a house to protect yourself from the monsters, and also, you know, go underground and kind of divert them. And so it's neat. I'm kind of like you, Johnny. I'm not really sold on the whole sandbox thing. It's never really been my kind of deal to make my own fun kind of thing, but you know, I'm willing to kind of try it out. So
yeah, well, we got a long letter from somebody this week, defending Minecraft against some of the things I've said about it. And against that, specifically against that charge of having to make your own fun, and he said, look, it has a survival mode, you can explore these caverns, there's monsters and stuff down in there. And I get all that, but to me, it looks like Terraria is a little more of an action game, and that there's more to the combat, like there are bosses, like you said. I think at some point you start to get a lot crazier kinds of items like jetpacks and laser guns and really flamethrowers and stuff that I don't think you could ever make in Minecraft. So to me, all that stuff sounds really fun. And then you put it in the wrappings of a 2D game, there's going to be more immediacy to it and more familiarity. And it's just, to me, it seems like it would be a lot easier to navigate that world in 2D than it is in 3D. So it's all very much more appealing to me, even though obviously they're very similar games in a lot of ways. It sounds really good, and it's obviously very cheap, so I can't buy it for a while, but eventually I will probably be giving Terraria a shot, and then you can be my guide, because by then you'll be an expert.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep, it's definitely a game you could sink some time into. I can see that, because there's really no...
Just what you and I need.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, James is up next.
Yep, so I've actually gotten to put time into Deus Ex Human Revolution.
Now, James, did you ever play the first Deus Ex?
A while ago, but it was already an old game at that point. Keep in mind that Invisible Wars came out something like 7 or 8 years ago now.
I think Deus Ex is fully 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah, I mean, it's a legitimately old game, and when I played it, it was already old, and its foibles, which there are many, became increasingly noticeable as it aged. Now, at the time, it was still revolutionary in its implementation of RPG elements in a first-person shooter, but the genre had moved on at the time I played it to the point where its weirdness was more than noteworthy. It was distracting, and its general ugliness was... also distracting, so I never really got into it.
Right.
I played a bit of Invisible Wars on somebody else's Xbox, since I didn't have one. But I know Invisible Wars is kind of regarded as being not great. But I actually got Deus Ex, A, because it was on sale, but I've been watching for it to come on sale. Because it got a lot of good press, and it was first Eidos game I had seen in a while that got a lot of good press.
Yeah.
And I was curious, if I played this game, would I see influence of their new corporate masters in it?
Oh, you mean Square Enix.
Yeah, which had bought them somewhere around, 2 years ago now? So it was about a year and a half of development under the Square Enix mastership, and I wondered if I would see their handiwork in there. I mean, obviously the game would have already been in development, but it was their flagship title at the time, so I'm sure Square Enix came in and goes, all right, let's see what you guys are doing over here.
Yeah, I mean, by most accounts, back at E3... Deus Ex Human Revolution was by far the most interesting and impressive thing that Square Enix had at E3.
At their booth, yeah.
Over and above all their Japanese stuff. I mean, they did have a particularly bad E3, though.
They did. I mean, they had this and Hitman, where they were giving out the stupid red ties. So I was curious about this, and I wanted to see how this game turned out. So I went ahead and I grabbed it when it was on sale. And now that my Xbox will be nice, I proceeded to play through the game. I am... in the second to last stage of the game. So I'm decently far into it. So the game is built is that you can develop your character as much as you choose. You don't have to develop it all the way out. In theory, you could beat pretty much any point in the game with the character you start the game with, although that's really not true. Simply because you just take too much damage from the bosses and you'd get destroyed. But effectively, the idea of the game is you can develop a character that's sort of customized to how you want to play the game. So you don't have to go into each room and just gat every living thing. Or you don't have to try to sneak around every corner. You can sometimes go in the room with a little flourish and clear a path. But the game wants to give enough flexibility that you can use various skills that your character has to navigate the levels. I'm trying to think of a good game to compare it to, and the game that I came back to was the old GameCube game 007 Nightfire, which in that game, it was the first game I remember doing this, I know that's not a great comparison, is that it was the first game where you could go into a room and just start shooting the ever-living crap out of everything, or you could try to find ways to get around the guards, like legitimately sneak around them. And the game actually rewarded you for doing that. This game is much more featured in that respect of trying to move through people, although it still seems to think the best conduit of doing that is either ducking behind desks or going through air vents, which is something I'm ready to see stop happening in games, because I'm pretty sure if you run a weapons plant that's super, super locked down, your air vents are going to have keys on them.
Yeah, also air vents seem to be able to support anybody of any type of weight or size.
Yeah, and
it's pretty remarkable.
And they're always exactly the same scale for a person. Oh, and they're always in the men's bathroom. Always. They're always there. Just go to the men's bathroom. It's going to take you right to the central processing core of the company.
Absolutely. There's a direct link. Every single blueprint has that.
But the game itself is, it doesn't actually let you be entirely stealthy. I mean, in theory, you could do it. So I only once ever cleared a level without being seen. And I mean, I don't go into the room going like, hey, what's up? I'm going to kill you all now. I try to get through as much of the level as I can without causing a disruption. Because once you do, the game becomes instantly much more difficult. Because alarms go off, guards come flying out of the woodwork, these big turreted robots come out of the wall and begin to pour more firepower on you than a small war zone. I mean, so you want to not be seen. But what I found is that the game doesn't always quite do it in a way that makes sense. Like, you can be sitting behind a desk, and a guy might walk literally right next to you and not see you. But then, as he turns around, hey, who's there? Damn it. Seriously? Go to hell, game. And then in other cases where you can just shoot somebody in the head, and his buddy doesn't even notice. Body falls down right next to him, but he wasn't looking in your direction, so everything's fine. But I've kind of gotten into a rhythm now that I'm enjoying of stealthy up until the point of I can begin executing people. And then I don't have to be stealthy anymore. And I feel like that's probably the only way you can really clear some of these stages is to basically hide in the ductwork, which no one ever thinks to follow you down, and just shoot them from the air ducts. I will say, though, that the addition of the hacking mechanisms actually does give some complexity, because that means you're exposed while you hack these computers, and these computers can give you means of turning off security systems or giving you resources and letting you get into other places of the building without having to go through the extended process of trying to kill your way in, which a lot of times can be a big advantage in the game, but still, it feels like in the end, you're still going to have to shoot a lot of people. And I'm hoping at the end of the game it tells me how many people I killed, because I was deliberately trying not to kill everyone. But I'm fairly certain that number is going to put me in the mass murderer territory. It's got, in terms of a world-building game, there is a really strong devotion to storytelling in this game, which is part of the series, but there's a lot of telling story through things you find in the environment that you can read, which... Well, I mean, other games do that, but for whatever reason in this game, it's always like, there's a guard right outside the door with a gun as big as my leg. Do I really want to sit here and read a newspaper about some riots that are going on outside? Or do I want to worry about the fact that that guy is going to kill me in about 30 seconds if I don't do something? So a lot of times you pick something up and go, is there a password on here I can use somewhere else? Nope, close. And then just proceed to keep going. You go into some incredibly seedy locations like... You go to Hong Kong in Far Future, which is basically just brothel, organized crime, pot hotel, organized crime, really seedy club, brothel.
Future I want to be a part of right there.
There you go. Or you go to a future.
Future is now, John.
or you go to a future Detroit that makes the Detroit from RoboCop look upbeat. It's like, wow, this is terrible. They were optimistic when they made that movie. Oh my God. It's... It's a very weird game, and it's got some kind of strange message about technology that I'm not sure if it's intentionally obscuring the message or if it's just not doing a good job telling it. Because a lot of times it's like, yep, everybody who is in this pro-technology human modification camp is a bastard. Oh yeah, but everybody who's not in it is also a bastard. So like, well, so the only person who's not a bastard is the main character. Awesome. I don't know what this game's message is anymore, except hate everyone. I'm looking forward to getting to the end of the game, not because I want it to be over, but because I kind of like where it's going. It's just
you do like it then.
I like it. It's just there's something that doesn't quite feel like they fully executed the idea. I will say it is really, really pretty, and it does a good job trying to tell a story, and it uses a lot of cinematics for a shooter. So that might be more Square Enix's hand in this. Like, if they make another game, I'll play it, but I still won't pay $60 for it. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I do think there's some room for replay, though, because you can build your character differently and approach levels kind of differently. So I basically built super vanilla average character who does everything kind of okay, because I don't know where the stats really should go. But unlike a lot of Western RPGs, you could still get through the game with this kind of like bland character who does everything okay.
Yeah.
Which I like.
That is important, I think. Because a lot of games sort of punish you for trying to be well-balanced.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll go next. And first off, I want to give I've got a couple non-Tendo games to talk about. But first, I want to give an update on a couple of Nintendo games that I talked about last week. And just wanted to say quickly that Nano Assault continued to be awesome. And I beat it, and I want to play it even more. There's an online leaderboard. There's some challenges that you can do that kind of give you like achievement type goals, like play through this level without using any bombs or without dying or something like that. Those seem really fun. There's some concept art you can unlock. I don't yet know if that's really worthwhile, but you can. And I just think the game's awesome. It's a showcase. I'm going to be showing it to people when they come to visit. And it's just really fun. I would be very happy to go back and play it some more. And I really do feel like the guys who made this, I mean, to me, this is... They do some things with especially the Star Fox type levels where you're behind the ship and you're going forward into the screen. And the 3D is so good on those levels. And this is just as impressive, or probably more impressive than Star Fox on 3DS, but it's a new game, you know? And I feel like if you're looking for someone, I mean, I don't know if Q Games is going to be doing other things. If Nintendo's not going to let Q Games make the next Star Fox, then I say let these guys do it, because I think they could kill it. I really do. I think this is not amateur hour by any means. I think they're perfectly capable of doing an awesome Star Fox game. Just based on this game alone, it's only half of the game, but it's fantastic stuff. Bosses, the enemy variety is just incredible. I don't think there are two levels that have the same enemies. So it's a wonderful game. And it's still only $20 brand new. The other one I wanted to update on is VVV, because I was a little tepid on it the first time I talked about it on the 3DS version, just because I felt like, you know, it's considerably more expensive than the Steam version, and it didn't seem to really do anything differently. Since then, I beat the main quest again. I beat it on PC the first time. I beat it again on 3DS, and I do think the controls on 3DS actually are plenty good enough. I mean, you know, some of the stuff I did is crazy difficult, and I didn't really have any more trouble on 3DS than I did on PC. I thought I would, but in the end, they work just as well, so I think that should not deter you. And I felt like there wasn't really any added value from 3D. Maybe there is from portability, but, you know, one thing I didn't count on the first time I talked about the game is all the extra levels that are included, because I kind of figured those would be a little bit throwaway, you know. As it turns out, there's not only are there like 30 of them, which is a lot, obviously, and possibility of more being added through DLC later on. They've talked about if it sells enough copies or something like that, they might do some free DLC. But I vastly underestimated the amount of content in each one of those player levels, because they're not like short sections like a level in the main game. It's basically an entire world, an entire game world created by some, you know, indie developer or whoever, friend of the original guy or whatever. But it's like huge expansion packs for the main game. So if you really enjoy playing VVV, VVV as I do, it turns out this version, the 3DS version, actually has a shitload more content than the PC version. Far, far more than I expected that they would have included. So it's awesome. And so I'm still playing it, actually, and I probably will be playing it for a very long time to come. So in that light, I think $7, go for it. Why not? I think there's nothing wrong with this version. It is just as good as the PC version, and clearly actually a lot better based on this extra content that you get. So it is your must-have 3DS game of 2012 right there. Two of them, really. And as far as new games to talk about, I've been playing a first-person shooter on my PC called Hard Reset. I briefly mentioned this a few weeks ago and just mentioning that I got it really cheap. But at the time, I mentioned hearing that it's only like 2 hours long, and that's a gross exaggeration. I've already played it for 5 or 6 hours, and I've got a ways to go still. So I'd say it's probably less than 10, but definitely a lot more than 2 hours long. And it is a graphical showcase. It looks really nice on my PC, and there's just a lot of fun technical stuff. The lighting effects and the shading and just the quality of the textures and everything is really good. But also the art design is really nice on this game. It's very much a Blade Runner looking game. You're in this kind of dirty, futuristic city with a lot of neon lights and holographic advertisements. And then the enemies you fight are all robots, and they usually have some kind of like saw blades on them, or they shoot missiles at you or something like that. But most of them actually just kind of run straight at you. They spawn in large numbers and they just run straight at you. And so it's a lot of crowd control, and sometimes they run at you faster than you can kill them, so it's a matter of dodging and stuff like that. And so I think it actually plays a lot like Serious Sam. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that series. Not the one that Mommy's Best Games did over the summer that was 2D, but the original 3D first-person shooter Serious Sam games are like, it's very old-school action-y despite looking very modern and very clean and nice, but the action is very, very simple. It's actually a little bit like Castle Wolfenstein or Doom, where the enemies they don't really use a lot of strategy. They either stand way back and shoot things at you from afar, or they just run straight at you and you just have to kill them before they get there. And it's really fun, you know, and I think it's good that the game isn't extremely long, because that could get tiresome, but as it is, it's a lot of fun to play, and again, it looks really nice. So I'm enjoying Hard Reset, and the music is terrible. I don't like the music at all, and the voice acting for the cutscenes is inadvertently hilarious. The writing's actually not that bad, and the cutscenes are shown in a really cool motion comic sort of style, but the voice acting is really horrendous, and I'm surprised that this actually got released in this state, because it really sounds like the first times anyone's ever read these words. Like, they don't understand anything about the story or the characters, and they did it in one take and had no one to direct them or anything. So it's really horrible voice acting, but kind of funny also for that reason. I find that I actually turn the volume down while I'm playing the game and listen to a podcast or something, because I don't like the music. But then once the cutscenes come on, I turn the volume back up so I can listen to the stupid actors. So, but Hard Reset's a lot of fun. I would recommend it if you've got a good PC. I don't know if it's all that interesting without the aspect of being a graphical showcase, but I've enjoyed it, and I got a really good deal on it. So, and then the other thing I played this week is not a video game at all, but man, it sure is related to video games, and that is Dungeons and Dragons. I played D&D for the first time in my life last weekend. I actually rolled the character for it almost a year ago. I got the red box for a friend, and we've been trying to get a group together to play it for ages and ages, and we finally did. So I had been exposed to it a little when I made my character, but I was doing just this little solo example mission that's in the book just to help you get your character built up. We hadn't actually played together, and it really is a group experience. It's basically a Final Fantasy game or a Dragon Quest or whatever you like, or a WoW, but each character in your party is played by a different person, and you all have to basically cooperate together to kill the enemies. And all those RPGs are based on Dungeons & Dragons, and really the only major difference is that instead of a computer doing all the random number generation and all the stat comparisons and all the bookkeeping, you have to do it yourself because you don't have a computer. So some of it you do on your end, and then you have a dungeon master who is almost kind of like the AI for the game. So like he controls the monsters based on algorithms, you know. Since there's no AI, let's say when it's the monster's turn, he has certain rules about, you know, if the monster has this many hit points, then he approaches and acts aggressively and tries to get close to you and flank you and do a melee attack. And if it's less than this number, then he tries to run away, and he tends to favor this kind of terrain. So it gives him a series of rules, like an algorithm, to control that monster. And so it was really interesting playing it, because I thought, you know, if I had played this as a kid, I would have understood it very much, but also would have thought it was kind of quaint, because I had already been exposed to video games that do a lot of the same stuff. They just automate it, and it all goes much faster. Now that I'm older, I can appreciate the retro appeal of it, that people did this before they could do it on computers, and yet they still were doing essentially the same stuff that I do now in RPGs. And then I also understand why people playing this felt the urge to automate a lot of the stuff that happens. You know, all the dice rolls and all the number keeping and a lot of that combat stuff to speed it up and to get to the good part faster, you know. But I also appreciate the fact that you're playing this cooperatively and that you're all doing it, you know, a lot of it is in your head or it's on paper and you're keeping track of it yourself. And that really adds to the fun of it. You know, it's part of the fun of playing a board game. There's certain things about playing board games that are fun that you can't really get from a video game. Because it's a board game, because it's physical, because you're all sitting around a table playing it together and looking at each other's faces while you do it, and you're not holding a controller. So I thought it was a lot of fun. We're definitely going to get back together and play it again. And, you know, probably a lot of our audience has had experience with D&D before, but if you've never tried it before and you do like RPGs, I think it's a must-have experience to play Dungeons & Dragons, because it'll blow you away how much you already understand how the game works, and yet it will also blow you away just how much stuff there is to do and keep track of that you take for granted when you play video games. And actually, I mean, I said Final Fantasy and Dragon Quest and all that stuff is definitely true, and that stuff definitely is heavily based on the old versions of D&D. But the number one thing that I thought of, because you have this map with a grid and you're moving and you're trying to flank guys and stuff like that, and there's a turn order that you have to, you know, based on the character's speed attribute. It's basically Tactics Ogre or Final Fantasy Tactics. So, James, I don't know if you've ever played D&D, but I bet you would pick up on it really fast.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just never had any interest in playing it, to be honest.
Well, fair enough. And if you tried it and didn't like it, that's, you know, that's your prerogative. But I think if you've never been exposed to the details of it, you would be really surprised when you saw how the game is actually played and how the rules are actually formed. Because I think Tactics Ogre and Final Fantasy Tactics are definitely the most direct corollary to the way that, at least the way our game was played in D&D. I was like, wow, this is basically Tactics Ogre with the dice rolls being actual dice rolls. But other than that, it was almost exactly the same. It was pretty amazing. So I bet you would like it a lot. I mean, I know I did. Anyway, so enough about that. We're going to wrap it up with Greg.
Yeah, nothing really new this week. Just following up on the thing we've talked about previous episodes. First of all, Shinobi 3DS from last week. I finished the main game there, beating that. No small feats, quite tricky, even just on normal, and they're still hard and very hard lingering out there. But what I enjoyed about the end of the game is definitely the levels get more focused on increasingly tricky platforming and enemy arrangements rather than, you know, some of this extraneous stuff that we've mentioned, like the horse riding or the surfing bit with the gyroscope and all that. You know, that all seems to sort of fall away, and it gets a nice sort of a feeling of momentum towards the end. And the last level has some really, really precise things that it asks you to do platforming wise that are pretty damn hard to pull off consistently, which certainly can make it frustrating, because it's still the very last level's not actually as long as some of the ones that precede it, but it's still long enough that sometimes it could just get annoying if you can't quite master one particular part of it to pull it off reliably, and then your progress is kind of getting bogged down. So that's another, that is, I mean, I think abstracting from the issue of whether these levels of this size are appropriate for a portable game, I think you could probably argue in some cases, certainly, they're just too long for the game design in general. Especially, I think, from the point of view of the score attack. Because, as I said last week, the score system is well conceived. I like it a lot, and there's a real feeling of getting on a roll that's very satisfying that comes with it. But in terms of actually playing for score, I think the length of the levels is a big deterrent to that. Because, you know, I think if you want people to get into a score attack mode, it's best if they could have, you know, maybe a level or two that are shorter that they could get to know really well and kind of master those, yeah, and then get into the finer points of scoring very highly.
Like a shoot 'em up.
Exactly. And I mean, this was something I said precisely the same point about Sin and Punishment 2. Some of those levels are just too long to be inviting for score attack play. And the solution might have been, you know, possibly to break them up a bit, maybe especially for score attack. attack, or maybe just break them up in general, or whatever. The same thing applies here, because the score system, I've really sort of taken more of an appreciation of it, having got to the end of the game and got more sort of proficient at actually maintaining the. But the big thing with the score system is not taking damage. If you could avoid taking damage, principally probably by using the parry mechanism effectively, your multiplier will carry over and so your points will be far, far greater. But it actually affects your character's movement speed. If you've got the maximum multiplier, well, at each level you can have like a 2x multiplier, 3 or 4. And at each of those increments, your character's movement speed will increase. And so it's really interesting sort of sensation because of, I mean, there is, I've heard people talk about just the way that like when you get up to the maximum multiplier, the way the numbers just sort of explode out of the screen in giant characters and they turn orange and stuff is really satisfying. But I think it's really embellished by the fact you are faster. All of a sudden you're just cutting through stuff much more quickly. Yeah, there's a sense in a lot of old games when you get power ups and stuff of momentum, of getting on a roll, but here it's almost literal in that sense, and it's kind of strange because in some ways it makes it easier, in some ways it makes it harder because it's a lot easier to just sort of roll right into something and take damage. And of course it affects the platforming. You know, your jumps will be longer, or it'd be easier to avoid certain obstacles if you're faster, or you know, it might be easier to run into them. It's quite fascinating. I'm not sure I've seen that very often, where, you know, how you're performing in that sense actually affects your core movement abilities and things. But I think I really like it, actually. I really like that idea. And I gained a lot of, once I actually got to the point where I was going for long periods without getting hit, I really appreciated what that did for the game. And the bosses get significantly more challenging towards the end. And I think the one thing I really appreciated as well was how deliberate they were with the enemies. I mean, each enemy has got like a certain characteristic about it that's very specific. So, for instance, it might be, well, you can't jump over this enemy. It'll just teleport up and get you. Or you can't throw projectiles at that enemy because it'll teleport and get you. Or, you know, well, this enemy only shoots high, so stay on the floor, don't try and vault over it, and so forth. And of course, when they pair those together, you've got to kind of read that enemy formation and say, okay, what am I allowed to do and what am I not allowed to do in this situation? And once you get that read on things, and obviously getting to know the levels helps a great deal in this situation, but going from moment to moment, doing the correct thing relative to the enemies that are in front of you and keeping that score going, it's very, very satisfying. I really like how deliberate the design is. None of it feels sort of throwaway or perfunctory in that sense. Mm. So I finished it. I enjoyed the ending a lot, and there's still plenty of content to go, similar to what you said, Johnny, about Nano Assault. There's like unlockable challenge levels that you can get for like achievements which are shorter and have sort of more demanding platform challenges, so that they could be pretty inviting. And then there's the Street Pass ones, which you can either get by Street Passing with someone who got Shinobi, which probably is not going to happen based on the massive price drops that happened shortly after it came out. I don't think many people picked it up. But you can also just use Play Coins. So I've unlocked a few of those there. The Street Pass ones are one hit kill. If you take a hit, you die. So it's like pretty much the absolute pinnacle of the sort of challenge. So I haven't played too many of those yet because I'm not going to spaz all my play coins on them just yet. But, you know, that's pretty cool. There's a lot of content in this game. It's really quite impressive.
Well, they actually, when I saw the game at E3, the producer was there from Sega, and he was saying that they were really, at the time, he said they were really focusing on getting a ton of content in the game, which, considering the other 3DS games that I saw at E3, that got my hopes up, because a lot of them felt like kind of thin, porty, not very deep experiences. So, that's good to hear that they actually delivered on that.
Oh, definitely. I think so. I mean, I haven't played that many of these challenge levels yet. The non-Street Pass challenge was, though you're unlocked by finding these star coin type, there's two star coin type things in each level. You collect both of those. That unlocks a challenge map. And the thing with them is basically they don't really have visual design. They just have this sort of random spacey background. So I guess that's kind of probably where they economized in terms of, you know, it's the exact same thing happened in Sonic Colors. where they had some challenge levels that were just a sort of generic visual kind of thing to add content to the game, but, you know, within budget, presumably. Mm-hmm. But it did have one of them, one of the ones I did play, did have like a unique boss in it, which I thought was quite surprising. So they definitely seem like they're going to be worth unlocking and playing, and I'm inclined to do so based on how much I enjoyed completing the game as it was. But, you know, I mean, this sort of game, I definitely got the very powerful sense, was just, it was aimed squarely at people like me. I mean, one of the achievements is actually called "Got to the Chopper." I mean, it's, you know, nice. It's like they're reading my mind. They know what I wanted from this game. Even though, funnily enough, this is my first Shinobi game. I've never played any of them because it's a Mega Drive series, and it's just not something I've got round to on the Japan Virtual Console. But considering, from what I've read, it does actually build off the real old Shinobi games quite well. I'm kind of more tempted to go back and try one now than I was before.
Well, I'm trying to think. The only Shinobi game I've put a ton of time into was the PS2 reboot, which is really good. Really good. I love it.
That was kind of a failed reboot, though, because it didn't really reboot anything.
Oh, well, there was a spinoff with the girl. I don't remember the name.
Yeah, we don't remember the name. And I mean, I've seen it be played, and I don't remember the name, so.
No, I'm interested in the series. People have a lot of good things to say about, you know, Shinobi 3.
Yeah.
Although there's some confusion about, because Shinobi 3 in Japan is the Super Shinobi 2. So I shall have to be careful if I do go poking around the Japan Virtual Console about which game I actually buy. But speaking of Japan Virtual Console, I've also been making a lot of progress on Mega Man X 2. I'm now at the part of the game where you fight all the bosses again.
Oh, joy.
I'm sure it doesn't surprise anyone that that happens in a Mega Man game. But, you know, having got that far, obviously, I've seen pretty much everything in the game now, and it's really, I have enjoyed this a great deal. I think it was enough time between this and the first one. It's been, you know, several months, probably, that, you know, it's obviously not that different, so.
No, it's not.
So you wouldn't want perhaps play it straight after or anything, but there are some significant differences that I've enjoyed, particularly the greater emphasis on secrets, I felt like, in this one. I mean, you've got like that scanner that specifically tells you where to start looking for a secret or something.
Oh, the headpiece, yeah.
Yeah, that's like one of his additional bits of armor. Actually, like this crosshair comes across the screen and might sort of give you a hint as to where to look for something. And I mean, really, you know, the classic progression with all Mega Man games is you know, once the first domino falls, then, you know, everything else falls into place. And in this game, it was very much like that with the secret stuff. You know, I was beating quite a few of the bosses, the regular bosses, and I was thinking, well, I haven't found any the life extensions or the sub tanks or the air dash or anything. And then I found the first one. Yeah, the first thing I found, which was the air dash. And then soon after, I found the secret scanner, the headpiece, and everything just started. I started expanding my health rapidly, getting sub tanks. And once I got the charge ability, which lets you, you know, use all the guns that you got from the bosses in a special way, where you can almost do like a shine spark with the fire power. And also, I mean, you get all these abilities, and all of a sudden you start thinking, oh yeah, you know, that thing I couldn't get, I can go back there and use this, you know, very Metroid. Actually, and I've started, you know, assembling as much power as I possibly could.
How do you feel about that, James?
I don't think it's Metroid-y at all, actually. Because
there's plenty of backtracking in the Mega Man X games.
No, I mean, it's a classic example. It's like you're on the dinosaur tank level, as it's called in Japan, anyway, with the alligator on it.
Yes.
You know, and there is a heart style, you know, heart-like health extension there in plain sight next to a bunch of spikes. And, you know, the first time you see it, I'm like, well, there's no way I can get that now. And then, you know, quite a lot later, I was like, I still can't get this. How the hell do I get it? And then eventually I got the special charge thing, which lets you do the shine sparky thing with the fire power up. And it's like, oh, that's it. I can get it now. You know, and that is exactly what happens in Metroid. You'll walk past a missile expansion or whatever three or four times, still can't get it, still can't get it, still can't get it. And then eventually you'll get something and you'll make the connection and say, right, let's go back there and get it. So, I mean, even though it's broken up into levels, you know, and you go through them in a linear fashion and all that, you know, you could see how they ended up taking this in the sort of ZX direction that they ultimately did, on DS, where it was much more like Metroid. And that's something about the game that I've really enjoyed. And the other thing is, just to back up what Johnny had said, the air dash, I think, is a very significant addition. Mainly because, you might remember when I talked about the original X, one of the things I didn't like about it was the vertical shaft stuff.
Right.
Which, you know, I found to be kind of excessive and slow and, you know, really kind of bogged down the gameplay when you got to this bit. But the thing with the air dash is it really does quicken those bits up, because you can switch sides
right
so much more easily. It just changes it. There's bits like the volcano bit where there's you're getting chased up the shaft by this magma. And yeah, you know, that doing that with the air dash is just illustrates how much easier, you know, how much more sort of instant that kind of gameplay becomes. And then of course, once you get to the Sigma's castle kind of stuff that I've been doing, you get more of that where it's trying to close the walls in on you and all. And it,
yeah, that shit's ridiculous.
It's necessary at that point, very seemingly anyway.
Yeah,
so
I once beat 2 without getting the upgrades just to see if I could, and that the Sigma's castle bit took maybe days.
I can only imagine. Well, it seems like it's set up for it, but yeah, I guess if you're really on your game, you could do it without it. But it in any case, it just makes it more fun. It takes a part of the game that I didn't really care for. Dev is still not my favorite part of the game, or the clambering, but it's much improved.
It's not as sadistic.
Yeah, so really, really enjoyed this. Still haven't seen the wireframe coup de grace. Yeah.
But,
look, if that's any incentive to beat all these bosses again,
it should be. It's really cool. I think that boss is super annoying, but it looks awesome. All right, well, that's going to wrap it for new business. Now we're going to take a break and come back with your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with James' review, long-anticipated review of Fishing Resort for Wii, which remarks that it's more than just fishing, although he'd be lying to you if he said you didn't do a lot of fishing in it. And then we have a review of Transformers Dark of the Moon Stealth Force Edition by Zachary Miller, which is...
Finally.
Which is a somewhat belated look at the Transformers game, where notably you can't transform.
Perfect.
Wow.
Aaron has her impressions of the 3DS title Night Sky, the most unique physics-based puzzler to, quote, roll onto the 3DS.
I'm excited for that one.
If that's a pun, I'm sorry I didn't filter it out.
Yeah, it was a pun, and it was that game was originally supposed to come out for WiiWare, and then it didn't, but it came out on Steam, and people really liked it, so now they're bringing it back to Nintendo after all with 3DS.
And this one doesn't have a pun, because he also has impressions for the 3DS of Dylan's Roland Western, which he calls, quote, Sonic meets Tower Defense, and I called it E3. What the F is that?
All right, and in our feature section, we have the Japan eShop Roundup by Danny Bivens, including exclusive early impressions of Game Boy Tetris. Sounds revolutionary.
And I don't think he writes about that Girls in Bikinis show that's on the Japanese 3DS this week.
All right, and we have another feature on Super Follen Brothers by Nate Andrews. How a family trio quietly coaxed musical magic from machines, starting with the C64 all the way up to the Dreamcast.
By the way, Game Boy Tetris is Alexei Pajitnov's favorite version.
Inside information!
He's only the dude who made it. He says that in every interview, though. And finally, we have the conclusion of our feature on the NWR staff's favorite 10 games of 2011. And our look back at last year comes to an end with a game coming out in 2012, Xenoblade Chronicles, plus our honorable mentions. And our staff has actually been working overtime with news, so actually a lot of the really good content for the past week or two on the site has been mostly in the news department, and there has been quite a lot of it. So if you're not checking out NintendoWorldReport.com every day, you, sir or madam, are missing out.
And I hate you.
Welcome back to the show. It's time for Listener Mail. The address, as ever, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can send us an email just like these people, starting with a letter to be read by John.
Jacob writes, "Hey RFN crew, with Miyamoto's recent statements about working on smaller games with smaller teams, what genre or type of game would you like him to tackle? Also, I just want to say I started to listen to RFN earlier this year, and it is easily one of my favorite slash one of the most high-quality Nintendo podcasts out there. Thanks so much for all of your hard work, guys."
Well, thank you very much for listening. I don't know, guys. I haven't thought about this deeply. I guess my feeling on it is that I don't think Miyamoto is going to say, I want to make this pre-established genre of game and do it my way. I think Miyamoto is a genre inventor, and so I would love for him to, especially if he's working on a smaller game, I would love for him to invent a new genre just like he used to in the old days.
Yeah, you'd like him to surprise you as well. I mean, if that's kind of what we've talked about with the role that he's been doing, he certainly hasn't had a lot of capacity to do that. You know, he's just been sort of overseeing the production of some established franchises and some newer things, of course, like with Wii Sports and all that kind of thing. But yeah, you'd like to see a sort of personal touch that's somewhat surprising. And certainly if you go back to Pikmin, I think that's what you got. Even though he didn't direct that game, you know, it was his concept. Mm-hmm. And the idea of taking the RTS genre to a large extent and really making it more action-based, simplifying it, streamlining it. You know, if he's not going to completely just invent a genre outright, reinventing one or putting a radically different slant on something would be the sort of thing that I'd like to see. Not that I'd be quite happy for just to make an entertaining, small-scale, downloadable game that has that kind of personal touch of his, and that's it. It doesn't have to be important. I mean, that's kind of part of, I would assume, his new role. But you'd like to see it shake things up a bit in an established template. And I mean, there's one that I don't think he would ever do, so it's probably just a lost cause, or maybe it's just too well-traveled in general. But I would love to see Miyamoto like do something like the shoot 'em up.
I thought you were going to go there.
Because the thing is, there are...
And John wants an MMO, and James wants a strategy RPG. Done.
there are shoot-em-ups that are easier. You know, they're not all just about, you know, oh, are you tough enough to take this on? But that's usually all they are, is easier. They're basically the same as every other shoot-em-up we've ever played. So it's something where you could actually shake up some of those conventions, do things differently, maybe some sort of puzzle kind of element. So, you know, I would like to see Miyamoto try something that's more in his arcade roots, but at the same time that's kind of progressive as well.
I'd like to see him do something with the music genre that's not Wii music.
I like to give us something with the music genre that is Wii Music. So,
but based on all of his comments back when Wii Music first came out, I don't know that he has a great imagination for that genre. I mean, the mechanics of Wii Music are so simple, and he wanted them to be really simple and accessible, but that also made them really boring because there was no skill involved, and also maybe because of limits to technology, but also not a whole lot of creativity either. So Wii Music ends up being a game that you barely even play. So if that's the extent of his ideas with music, then maybe he should leave that to the experts.
I kind of feel like if you asked me 6 years ago what a Miyamoto music game would be like, I might imagine what Rhythm Heaven is. And so I don't know if Wii Music's been done or Rhythm Heaven's been done. Yeah, I'm not seeing exactly where he would go with it. But then if he's going to surprise us, then pretty much anything we say could be ruled out.
Well, so in the spirit of that comment, let me get away from the design of it. I would love for Miyamoto to do the graphics and the animation for this game, because he is an animator to begin with, and he drew Mario, and he drew all of those characters back in the day, and he still draws them. If you're ever fortunate enough to meet him, he might even draw a little sketch for you if he signs something. And you see, you know, people put up pictures of that kind of stuff all the time. And I think it would be fantastic for a hand-drawn Miyamoto game. Can you imagine? Even if the graphics are very simple, like even like Swap Note, like a game made with Swapnote, but I think his style would come through beautifully, and I think that would be awesome. And how long has it been since Miyamoto drew character art that ended up in a game, or even was used in a game? You know, even like concept art. I can't think of anything for 20 years, so I think that would be fantastic to get a game that is like literally looks like a Miyamoto game because he drew it.
Well, the one thing I would say about if he was going to go that sort of approach, you know, almost the marketing thing of it was like, well, it's not an established IP, so we can't sell it that way. We've got to sell it as very much his game. You know, this is completely his and it's all his idea and he's doing way more of it than he normally does and all
he,
that.
He returns to his roots kind of thing.
Yeah.
It would kind of help sell it, probably, I think, to some extent. But whether he's actually got the desire, the inclination to do it, or whether he think he could actually do it better than other people that are there at the company now, that that's their only job, is another matter.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, he may not really be up to speed on all the digital art tools, you know, all the pads. And anyway, it's a good question, but right now, we just, it's hard to say. And like I said, for me, I would like him to just kind of do something that you've never seen before. Cause like, you know, back in the days of Donkey Kong and Legend of Zelda and with Mario, there was nothing like those games before. He wasn't even refining ideas. He was like just putting out games that you couldn't even have imagined before that. And that's harder to do nowadays, probably just because there are so many games and they've been around for longer. But I don't know, maybe he's still got one of those really off the wall, crazy things, left in him. This seems like the time to do it. So, we shall see. But James has the next letter.
Plugbugs writes, "Hey RFN, I have a question for you, salt." Really? "I have a question for you fine, sultry gentlemen to ponder. There are rumors going around that EA's Origin and Valve's Steam are both trying to be on the Wii U. Assuming that it is true, and there is an established online system by Nintendo, do you think having too many online platforms that require sign-ins and separate downloads, like Portal 2 for the PS3, especially if the system doesn't remember these details, may cause a fragmented experience? I like the potential of Steam being on Wii U, if it means that Steam games have the potential of coming to the platform. But adding in Origin and multi-platform gaming means the online store doesn't necessarily mean a one-stop shop anymore. Nintendo would need to create a centralized environment for all these to coexist, which doesn't seem likely given Nintendo's, quote, do what you want, unquote, approach. What is your thoughts? Too much online platforms is good or bad? Question mark." Although I feel like if you say too much, you've already answered the question, haven't you?
I think more than one is better than zero. I say, if you know, it, like, competition is good. It makes everyone work more efficiently. It brings down prices. I say, let these guys do it.
It does make browsing kind of a pain in the ass, though.
But more than it currently is?
I think if it complements what Nintendo does, it's worthwhile.
I like the idea of having people who would be relative, you know, experts in their fields compared to Nintendo competing with each other to offer you services again. You know, you think you're going to get a higher quality rather than just, well, we're Nintendo, we have a natural monopoly here, and we're going to serve up whatever we can, and you're just going to take it, which is where we've been.
I'm not so much worried about these guys dividing the system or having too many interfaces. I'm more concerned about Nintendo's own interface getting in the way of these other platforms working. I mean, if Nintendo is going to be hands-off, they should be hands-off and let these guys get real deep in the system.
I think being hands-off is potential for a problem, because I feel like...
Well, sure it is.
You want to have a consistent look and feel throughout your environment. Even though Microsoft offers tons of competing video providers on their service, they still kind of follow the current Xbox UI. I mean, if you look at the newest version of Netflix, it looks a hell of a lot like the Microsoft interface for the Xbox.
And everyone hates it, by the way. But
they do. They do all hate it. But at least you have a consistent connect-required experience. But keeping that consistency does mean you only have to learn one interface.
I agree.
Well, I think what I think Nintendo really needs to do is create some sort of reliable launch pad from which everyone else can kind of take their cues, but within reason, you know, do what they want, offer their different whatever services they're going to provide. I mean, it would be good if you could have one login for the whole thing, but then could somehow carry over to the different service providers, because that would definitely be sort of emblematic of the fact that this is very fragmented.
So you're saying one universal friend code that would apply to Steam and Origin?
No, but I mean, on that platform, on your console, I mean, that's the thing. It may be,
yeah.
They may still tie it. The way they kind of get around that is the way that it's been so far. Everything that Nintendo's done has been having it tied to the specific console.
Mm-hmm.
And it may still be tied to that specific unit. But if it is tied to that specific unit, well, then what's the problem of saying, well, all these different services that are operating on this console should have one login if that login is defined by the hardware? You could have a sort of diverse service, but you want to avoid it feeling like it's very sort of piecemeal, because I think that will compare unfavorably with, especially, you know, what Microsoft is doing and things like that. So,
well, yeah,
they need to kind of put some sort of veneer of consistency on it to make people feel like this is a cohesive interface that they're dealing with.
Yeah, like, you know, like link your Nintendo ID to your Steam ID or something like that, and then have somewhere in the GUI where you can go and manipulate those.
So here's – I mean, I've seen people mention this, and we've talked about it on the show before, and people are excited at this prospect. But what I don't get, and I still don't get this with the PS3 either, is I don't get what the plus is here, because nothing you release on Steam now on the PC is going to be compatible with the Wii U.
Yeah.
I don't know that I agree with that, James.
No,
I think it's completely possible.
I can tell you explicitly that is the case, because they use Windows libraries or they use Mac libraries. You would have to release new games or new versions of existing. Like I said, nothing on Steam right now,
okay,
this second,
no,
is compatible.
You were correct that Wii U will not be backwards compatible with the Steam library. But
yeah,
that is not to say that you can't put Wii U games on Steam. They already do it with Mac, and I think that is the case study for proving, and Steam has been incredibly popular on Mac OS. I have a lot of friends who are now playing PC games for the first time in a decade because now they can play it on their Mac. And I think that's been very successful, and it makes sense to me that Valve would like to break into the console space. I think with PS3, they were already competing with Sony's own shop, and so they brought Steam to the platform in an incredibly limited, constrained way. And I still think Steam on PS3 as a part of the Portal 2 experience is really nice. It lets you not only interact with people who are playing on their PC or their Mac, but actually lets you play the game with those people at the same time, and it works really well. I like I said, I beat the co-op with a friend of mine, and he was playing on his Mac, and I was playing on my PS3, and I think that is a great experience. And if you can play Wii U games online with people on their PCs and Macs, I think that would be fantastic.
It would be absolutely fantastic.
I think it is possible that some of the games that you can buy digitally over Wii U could be sold through Steam. Maybe not all. Maybe Nintendo sells their own games through their own shop, and EA sells their own games through Origin, and that's fine. But there would be some games that you could buy through Steam, which means you could take part in the sales that they do, and you could take part in the community features that they have. And I think I would like for Nintendo to be able to tie some of these things together across the different online modules, you know, so that you don't have to have a separate friends list on Steam and a different one on Origin, a different one for Nintendo friend codes or whatever. And I would like for them to all be unified in some way, but in terms of having different front ends, I don't see a problem with it. You know, people have Netflix and Hulu Plus and Amazon and whatever all on their TVs now, and they don't seem to mind navigating different stores in order to find the content that they want.
I don't think it would work, to be honest. I legitimately don't think that system would work out well. I mean, it's not that it couldn't. I just don't think that the parties involved are going to have the same level of commitment from all stakeholders to make something like this work. I would much rather have a singular online system.
The problem is, if it's going to be a singular online system,
it's going to be Nintendo's.
Can Nintendo deliver it well? I mean, that's the thing.
No, I mean, there's no doubt they can. It's a question of, do they feel like they need to develop the resources for it? And if they bring in a company with experience to make an online platform for them, great, do that. That's fine. But I still want the console holder to be the major stakeholder here.
Mm.
I want them to be able to say at some point, we want to upgrade this experience to integrate it with the system more fully if they decide to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if you have a third party providing that system, there's no impetus for them to reintegrate it into the system in new ways. They just want to sell you the game. But Nintendo wants to sell the system. So if they can add new functionality, they have a reason to do it.
I see your point. It could go either way, and Let's just say E3 is going to be extremely interesting when it comes to the whole online platform thing, because I think you can see with 3DS, they're making great strides towards competence and beyond competence now.
I actually think how they do the eShop, though, with these kinds of like featured game titles, I think that's the first step towards them actually being able to do things like sales. Because they re-promote games on the front, as opposed to if you look at the old Wii Shop, where it was just a list.
Yeah, the first thing you see on Wii is a menu, basically. Like, what genre do you want? Well, I don't know.
Yeah, but if you look at eShop, every week they're re-rotating games into these very attractive-looking banners that, I mean, they're going to have at least 2 years between when they did initial eShop design for the 3DS and when they do it for the Wii U. I feel like they can make great strides in that time frame.
Yeah, but the shop is a narrow part of what we're talking about here.
The friends list has been better, too, on 3DS. They've done a good job with
that. I think the friends list on 3DS is actually pretty good.
I wish it was... And now I've got like 60, 70 friends on there, so maybe I'm an outlier case, but I feel like it is a little hard to scroll through and find a person because you only really see one or two names at a time on there. So it could be organized in a more top-down way. But it is responsive. It does actually show you when people are online. And even with the friend code, you know, one thing I've noticed on 3DS is that if someone else has already put in my friend code and they send me theirs and I put theirs in, they show up immediately as, okay, now you're friends. Whereas on Wii, it was this, and the original DS was this horrible experience of, and we used to talk about this on the show. We would put each other's names or codes in and then wait weeks for it to finally do some
the Smash Brothers experiment.
Their handshake server was like only turned on for 2 hours a day, like the electricity in Iraq. So now they've really, it's much more persistent. It's much more immediate now. It works the way that you would expect it to.
Actually, one thing that I was surprised to see when I turned on the eShop today, actually, was they have a section, and some of our listeners will roll their eyes, but go screw yourself. They have a portion.
Keep the customers coming back, James. That's the way to do it.
They have a portion of the eShop that's called the IGN recommendations.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I think they did Nintendo Life over here.
They stole that card straight from the Xbox, which has an IGN recommendation section.
Hey, how do we get on that gravy train?
I don't know.
Really? Come on.
How about the RFN recommendations? We could, you know, we've got plenty of them.
But I do think stuff like that matters. They're providing mechanisms.
There's no real doubt that Nintendo's going to have their own online store and they're going to sell a whole load of shit from that, and that's going to be, you know, where most Nintendo fans buy sort of digital content, because that's where they'll be putting all their own stuff out from and all that. But and hopefully they're going to keep improving in that regard. But in terms of some of these other elements of it, it goes more to the whole online infrastructure, and that's where I'm not so confident about what's going to come out of it if they're going to take a step back from it.
Yeah, because they sort of tried that with Wii and DS when they went with GameSpy for their online architecture, and it was a train wreck.
Yeah.
So that was a long time ago, and I think they've learned a lot from that experience. And you can see with 3DS, they're as far as I know, they're not using GameSpy for 3DS,
aren't.
Or they're certainly not relying on them to the degree that they did, because they seem to think that going with this well-known name in online matchmaking from 10 years ago would give them, you know, a lot of credit among gamers, and that it would, and that all these problems would just sort themselves out. Well, you trade your friend codes, and then GameSpy will do the rest. And forget it, you know. I mean, it's not even a service. It's just a matchmaking. They basically, GameSpy hosted their matchmaking servers, and that's just not going to cut it, you know. I mean, they never gave the tools to the developers, and there's no front end for it. There's barely a back end for it. It's atrocious. So I'm with James. I share your skepticism and your caution in Nintendo in the way that they've been talking about this, and there are many ways that this could go wrong. I just want to say, I think, as Plugabugs, you know, sort of lays out there as a possibility, I think this could also go really right if they get out of the way of these companies and make it easy for us to use these services. Now, if there's a huge bureaucracy of Nintendo in the way between me and Steam, and I have to deal with Nintendo and then I have to deal with Steam to do any of this stuff, that's terrible. But then they've really kind of defeated the purpose of allowing these other services on their platform in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like to me some of this process is that they don't want to be doing things that get in the way. They don't want to be occupying themselves with some of these things.
Yeah, there's a lot of money to be made. you know, if Nintendo's got any damn sense, they will gain the competency that they have lacked in the past, because I think it's in their best interest to do so, because they can make a lot of money selling these games online and getting people to play games online.
It's, for this to work, Nintendo has to play a limited role, but an effective limited role. Mm. That's the problem I've got. If they're completely hands-off, I don't think it will work, because it will be too fragmented, as Pluggerwork suggested. But on the other hand, if they're reaching too far, you get the bureaucracy that Johnny talks about.
One thing I will say is that a lot of the problems that we have with Nintendo's online, at least their online retailing of titles, like their actual methodology for selling games, could be alleviated if they weren't total assholes about it, about who they want. Who they want to provide resources for development to, who they want to allow to sell their software. Because their philosophy doesn't necessarily make sense. I mean, I get that they don't want to be sending out kits to every person on Earth who thinks, I'm going to make a game. And I understand that they want to have a certain amount of quality control in that, yes, this game functionally works. Hmm. But to an extent, they're just shooting themselves in their own foot. Because maybe they don't want to load the system up with crapware. But there's plenty of games out on the DSiWare shop now that are crap, and they are technically
there's plenty of legit crapware out there. That's the problem.
But there's nothing out there. There's nothing out there that doesn't just not work.
So James, with WiiWare and DSiWare, Nintendo actually kind of got the worst of both worlds, because they made it actually. It's still. I know you're complaining that, you know, like, indie developers have a hard time, but the WiiWare development units were among the cheapest you're ever going to find for any console.
Yeah, but they wouldn't sell them to you. Is the problem?
Yes, they would. You just had to have an office. It's not even that hard. You just have to rent out a space. So that you're not making it out of your house, which is a silly requirement. Okay, don't get me wrong. But it was not that hard to be a WiiWare developer. The problem is very hard to make money on it. Very hard. And the problem is, not only did they make it more difficult than it should have been for garage developers to get involved in this and have like a breakout hit, they also made it very hard for even major publishers to make money on WiiWare because of all the arcane rules and the crappy marketing that they provided. So it was really, again, the worst of both worlds, and very few people really found success on the platform. And same with DSiWare.
It's not, it's more than that, though. It's how they handled relationships with the publishers. I mean, remember, we talked to publishers who said they didn't know when their game was going to come out.
Yeah.
Nintendo would get it, and they'd sit on it and go, what week can we slot that into?
Or didn't know when they were going to get paid for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a much bigger problem.
Well, nobody's getting paid till the game comes out.
I mean, but one of the key distinctions as well between the way Nintendo's been running things as well is, you know, the way they've been setting pricing. That is another issue. If you were to have different venues, each accessible from the same console, that had very different attitudes towards pricing in terms of, you know, we talked about Steam sales. There aren't sales on Nintendo platforms, and then just lower prices in general. Where does that kind of rub up against Nintendo's philosophies about, well, you can't price games too low because it destroys the value of the entire industry?
Well, you know, I think if Nintendo doesn't want their games to be priced too low, then they shouldn't price their games so low. But on Steam, publishers set the prices, and that is Nintendo should take their percentage cut regardless, but it should be up to the game publishers to determine the prices, because it's up to them. If they want to sell more copies, that should be their prerogative, right? Because Nintendo's not going to help them. So the problem with Nintendo's store is that once the game's up there, you just better hope it sells, because it's completely out of your hands at that point, right? And that should not be the case.
Well, yeah, it shouldn't be the case, but the two questions. First of all, if Nintendo shop were to coexist with other shops on the accessible from the same console, would that signal perhaps that they're going towards a place which is less controlled in that regard? Which, I mean, the whole approach is, oh, it's open, you do it, so maybe they are going in that direction. But if it's not, can Nintendo's sort of, you know, highly controlled marketplace happily coexist with ones that are, you know, more liberal? Does the presence of them somehow threaten Nintendo's own ideas? Would they, in fact, sort of put lines of demarcation and say, well, if there's a game on Steam that's selling for $2, well, then you can't sell it for $2 on Wii. And this is the sort of bureaucracy that, you know, you were hinting at earlier, because all this notions of value stuff that it was talked about at GDC last year, you know, is all of a sudden playing out on a Nintendo platform side by side almost.
But I mean, they could lose loosen the reins in their own shop as well. They could say...
Exactly. Well, that's what I said. Maybe it suggests that they are going to, but that would be a big step if they did.
Yeah, I mean, right now, actually, and I spoke about this just a minute ago when we're discussing the 3DS's eShop. You can actually find a game that didn't come out this week now because on that front screen. We laugh, but that is a huge improvement. And publishers seem to know when their games are going to come out because we can find out ahead of time.
Well, and the size restriction is much different, you know, as I talked about. Mighty Switch Force is bigger than some retail games.
I got to imagine Swapnote must be huge. I haven't looked at it, but it, anyway, you know, and then the other thing is on the demo front now, they are releasing demos of retail games in Japan, and they will be soon in America. Probably Resident Evil will probably end up being the first one. But then also on WiiWare, just this happened today, but they maybe on purpose, maybe not, released all the WiiWare demos.
All 50 demos.
All at the same time, which is the way it always should have been in the first place.
Came back suddenly.
Maybe this signals a change of heart from Nintendo on how they approach demos and say, you know what, demos should just be out there because maybe someone will play the demo 2 years after the game comes out and realize they still want to buy it.
Yeah. And to me, it wouldn't be much of a thing for Nintendo to say, all right, going from where they are on the eShop, they've already loosened the reins a little bit. Because publishers, like I said, publishers know when their games are going to come out. They can give us review codes now, which is nice.
Yeah.
And we can actually get the game off the service before it's out.
Doesn't that actually kind of tell you that the game's already on the shop? It's just not publicly accessible? That's more like the partner net that Microsoft's been doing on Xbox since 2005.
So I feel like the next step for them logically is to loosen the reins even a little bit more on the Wii U and maybe say, okay, you can do sales now.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the next step logically, because I feel like it was the next step logically about 10 steps ago, but it might be the only logical step left that they haven't
done. Well, I mean, really, there's really only two at this point, which is we let you price your own games, and they could do one of two things. Like, we're going to take a percentage regardless of what you price that. Mm-hmm. Or they could even say, we're going to take minimum this amount.
Right. Like, we're going to take $2 off the top, so I don't think you want to price it less than $2. Right? Yeah. I mean, that would really solve Iwata's problem, and it would keep prices high, but it would also give publishers a lot of leeway.
Right. They could say, we're going to take a dollar minimum or 25%, whichever is higher for us. Mm-hmm. And that way, nobody's going to say, okay, here's our 50-cent game. They're going to say, okay, here's our $2 game.
Right.
And you know, there are $2 DSiWare games.
But there are not $2 eShop games, and there may never be, but the amount of effort that takes to make an eShop game means your game is probably worth a lot more than $2.
Well, I mean, a lot of the DSiWare games are really simple puzzle games, and $2 might be just fine for them. And
that are good?
That are simple puzzle games. I mean, there's one about this German company put out about like a rabbit who gets carrots and stuff. I don't know. But they told me their press release told me I should be excited because it's finally coming to the DSiWare. I'm like, finally. I didn't know. God. I was waiting for it.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next letter. Cliff writes, love the podcast, guys. I have a non-Nintendo question, though. Elder Scrolls V Skyrim seems to be eating up all the praise in the world from the internet media. I've seen it on numerous lists for Game of the Year, but it seems it's getting a big pass since it doesn't seem to work on one-third of the platforms it's on and is buggy on the other two. My question is, why doesn't the game media hold the industry's feet to the fire when it comes to these bugs? I can't count how many times I've heard a reviewer say, quote, it's not enough to ruin the experience, unquote. Why are these bugs deemed acceptable? Now, my answer to Cliff is, they say it's not enough to ruin the experience because it's not enough to ruin the experience.
Unless you're playing the PS3 version of that game, at which point it apparently does ruin the experience.
And I emailed Cliff directly about this, but the fact is, the PS3 version did not get much attention at launch because Bethesda didn't send out the PS3 version for reviews. And you can only review the game that you played. So if you didn't experience these crippling bugs when you played the game, you're not going to complain about them. You can report on them when other people see them and other people complain about them. But if you're complaining that reviews don't complain about things that the reviewers never experience, I think you don't understand how reviews are done.
Here's my thought, especially on situations like this. If you are a multi-platform outlet and you're reviewing the game, you probably should experience all the platforms it's on. just to make sure that one platform isn't horribly
cribbed. Yeah, and some do. Some do. I think GameSpot has a policy of, number one, they don't accept like unfinished review copies, and number two, they do go out and purchase the games for themselves and play all the platforms, which is hard to do, and it makes the reviews late sometimes, which means that probably a lot fewer people read them.
But I mean, they must have sent it out to like official PlayStation magazine or whatever. So,
well, maybe they sent them the PC version and said, "Well, the PS3 one's like this." I mean, we've had people do that. We on Planet GameCube, we used to have people send us Xbox and PS2 games and say, "Oh, the GameCube version's the same," and we'd be like, "No, it's not."
Well, the whole thing is, particularly with Skyrim on PS3, is that you did not encounter that bug until you got very, very deep into the game, because it dealt with the size of your save file. Basically, your save file got so big that the PS3 didn't, because of the way they deal with RAM, they didn't have enough room probably for the VRAM to load the world as you move through it.
Oh,
so what happened
Lord.
Is your frame rate would get worse and worse and worse as your save file got bigger and bigger and bigger as you got deeper into the game.
Why is this game turning into a slideshow?
Now, in their defense, they supposedly do have it patch coming out by the end of this month, apparently, to fix that.
But that game's been out for how long now?
It's been out for a while. But, I mean, they've had problems like this before with PS3.
Well, Bethesda's had problems like this in every game they've ever released, ever.
Yeah, Bethesda,
They must have, like, the worst bug ratio of any developer ever.
But that's it. I mean, the fans of Bethesda's games, I mean, I'm sure they're as familiar with them as anyone, because they're the people that play it to the end, or they would play it like multiple times. They'd almost be like bug testers because they're so thorough.
And
so they know, but it doesn't ruin the experience for them.
And
so,
if you're the kind of person who's extremely sensitive to buggy games, you probably know better than to play a Bethesda game.
Especially like when it first comes out. I mean,
most of us are somewhere in between those two extremes. So I notice them and they annoy me, but I move on. Usually it's a very localized thing and I say, "Oh, that's funny," and then I turn and go the other direction and I never see it again.
But it's like anything. I mean, at the end of the day, there's plenty of things that probably a lot of us encounter in our daily lives that, you know, you think, well, that's wrong or that shouldn't happen. But how much does it actually affect you? Like, are you going to get all enraged or...
It affects you as much as you let it affect you, right? I mean, I hate to get philosophical, but geez, you can't obsess over things.
For reviewers and consumers alike, but especially for reviewers, I think it would be disingenuous, to say the least, if it's like, well, I encountered this bug, it didn't bother me, but because I'm reviewing the game, I've got to act all outraged about it. I mean, you don't want that. You don't want people phoning in outraged just because, you know,
there's too much of that in the world already.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you want a genuine response to the game when it's being
reviewed.
And
I think most reviewers said, "Look, this game is buggy, and I love it." And you have to find a way to make those things compatible, because that is how you honestly feel. And I want reviewers to be honest about their feelings about these games. And I think I read that, and I heard that on a lot of podcasts. And I take people at their word. I think yes, they saw these bugs, and no, they didn't care. And that's how I feel about the game.
And I mean, you probably have a sense yourself of how much that sort of issue would affect you compared to how they were affected by it. So you just have to sort of apply it to your own standards and reactions and wonder whether the purchase remains worthwhile for you. But again, especially if you've got a range of reviews that are honest reactions, then you will be able to look at all those and make that determination for yourself on a pretty solid basis. So I don't think there's any problem that they're obscuring something or covering it up or whatever. It's there for you, all the information to make that decision for yourself.
I would say if the scale of the bug on the PS3 version is as bad as what I've seen, which I've just seen video of the game devolving into stutter motion.
Well, didn't they make it worse with the patch, though? I mean, in some respects, which, again, I mean, reviewers can't foresee that.
That's
the
Bethesda thing right there. Bethesda patches something and breaks it, then they patch it again and fix it.
The only thing you could do, to some extent, which is something, you know, I've heard certain outlets in the past say, is that they could do a sort of almost a re-evaluation of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Especially humongous games like a Skyrim. You know, how do we feel about it 2 months later when we've played more of it and other people have played more of it? Or especially games that are online, you know, how's the online community? You know, it's not something that gaming publications or sites necessarily get into that much. But, you know, if they did, I think that would probably be the appropriate venue for some of this stuff that takes in broader considerations than just, you know, I played the game, this is my experience, this is my critical evaluation of it that you get in reviews.
Yeah.
I would, to go back to the origin question here, I would say that if you are writing a game of the year situation and you feel like the PS3 version is bugged, you should probably say, our game of the year is Skyrim for the Xbox 360 and PC.
That's exactly what a lot of people did.
Parentheses, F the PS3 version.
No, that is exactly what happened at a lot of publications.
I do think if you're a review outlet and they didn't send you a PS3 version of them, you should be calling me like, hey guys, what are you hiding from me right now? Just curious, what's up?
Well, I mean, I would imagine there was probably were PS3 specific outlets that got PS3 copies, and even in their case, they may well have been able to enjoy the game, perhaps even especially before it started getting patched, without yeah. it ruining the experience. I mean, it still may have been more diminished than it would have been if they were playing on a 360, but you know, it sounds like, you know, the qualities of the game are such that they still may shine through even then. And again, I mean, I would not ask the reviewers to say, oh, well, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it's terrible, isn't it? You know, 5 out of 10.
If there are significant bugs that you see, even if you enjoy the game, you do need to devote proper amount of space.
Agreed.
And you can't just say there are some bugs, but I didn't really care. You need to document what these bugs are. And
we
what
always
saw.
Have, James. I mean, I've done it. You've done it. We've all done it. You know, when we review games and you hit a nasty bug, you say, look, this is especially back in the old days when there wasn't a way to patch the games.
Well, no, especially when it's a bug, you're just like, what the F?
Well, they may have talked to somebody in PR and said, hey, you know, I'm playing the PS3, you know, Skyrim, and I'm seeing this bug that, you know, the frame rate's dropping the further I go. And they may have said, well, we know that, you know, you don't know what kind of goes on behind the scenes, because, you know, we've done that. I know that's the thing with us. I mean, we've done that. We've seen a bug and we brought it up to PR.
And we said, is this actually the final version of this game? And they'll be like, yeah. And I'll say, okay, well, then I got to talk about this bug. I mean, I got it, because you're telling me this is the final version. And otherwise, you know, if they say, well, we might have done some like some final bug testing before that shipped, I say, okay, I still have to mention it in my review, but I will also mention that I played a pre-release version and that this may have been fixed.
My favorite was the, we saw this bug and we knew it was a pre-release. Has it been fixed? That's not a bug. No, it is. It's a bug. Like, you might need to go reopen your QA a little bit. That happened.
Okay, well, we've got one more email this week, and John's going to read this one.
Sergeant Foster in Okinawa writes, dear RFN crew, and especially Dr. Metz, I know you're not that kind of doctor, but I needed a booster shot of Nintendo in the arm because I'm feeling a bit down. I am officially a Nintendo fanboy, tatted on my arm. He has a tattoo, if anybody's ever seen it on our site. But my symptoms are as follows. I'm still not feeling the 3DS and how it's being handled, or in this case, T-bowed. Don't get me wrong. I love me some Tebow.
Kill me.
In the end, he's a winner, but it sure is ugly getting there. Current sales are good. A redesign is imminent. But the ambassador program is discriminatory, meaning, for whatever reason, one doesn't have an early 3DS. You can't even purchase those games until when? How long do you have a timed exclusive to your own consumers?
I paid $100 extra for this. You shut the F up.
Anyone who just got a 3DS for Christmas and hear about the GBA games that they can't have won't understand nor be too happy. Then I may have Skyward Sworditis. I'm always excited for a new Zelda. I've loved and played them all. Seasons, Ages were kind of meh. I pre-ordered Skyward Sword, got the cool Wiimote, nerded to the CD, got my bird, my sword, went below and beat Resident Evil 4. HD PS3, bought New Vegas PS3, Murder, She Wrote. What happened? Lastly, I'm stressed about fall 2012. We'll have the Wii U. The name is still stupid no matter what concept they BS us with. Sure, it has great potential and means well, but it feels like I, the consumer, am a proud parent of Nintendo. My 240-pound eighth grader is running the last leg in the 400-meter relay. No matter how much I cheer, he ain't gonna make it. Diagnose me, Doc. If JJ says I have quitchabitchum, tell him I took Xenoquil and I still feel awful. Sorry this is a bit lengthy, but it's been a minute since I wrote in, and you guys are so good at what you do. I feel as if I'm having a conversation with you as I'm writing. As usual, slob, 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 as in slob of the knob for the people listening at home. You guys are great. Full stop.
Now, if you use full stop, not period, so we win that one, despite being United States Marine.
I must have read this email 5 times, and it still cracks me up every time I look at it. Quitchabitchum, Xenoquil, slob, slob, slob. Oh, man. So Sergeant Foster needs a little pick-me-up for his Nintendo spirit. What do we tell him?
I will have no complaints about the ambassador thing. I'm sick of what James said.
Yeah.
We paid for those games.
Yeah, those games were not free.
Well, look, the ambassador games are a convenience, but they are hardly exclusive to 3DS. Those games are available on a Nintendo Entertainment System or Game Boy Advance near you. So if you really want to play Fire Emblem the Sacred Stone, there are copies to be had, even if you are not an ambassador.
much less than I paid for my copy. Both times.
Right.
I mean, they are actually starting to sell the NES, or in this case, Famicom games in Japan. Mario and Zelda are already out.
And we all know GBA will follow. Even Nintendo says they will not, but we all know that is not true. They can make a ton of money selling those games. And at this point, if they decide to renege on their promise to ambassadors that they will never sell these GBA games, how many people are they really pissing off? Like, a couple hundred thousand? Who cares?
I think they'll leave it long enough that people wouldn't be that annoyed. And still, yes, you got them for free. You don't have to pay for them, which right, people will have to do when they actually...
As long as the full-featured versions come out and we get to download the full-featured version.
And that's already happening in Japan.
Yep.
There's already, with the Famicom games, you could download the updated game and you get the save state functionality, the full save state functionality.
Yeah, so I don't care.
Though, for people on the other side of it, you're getting it cheaper. You're getting the system cheaper.
A lot
so
cheaper.
That's the flip side of that coin. But in terms of, you know, whether you want to pick up a 3DS at all, well, you know, I mean, that comes down to how excited you are about the games coming out on it. And, you know, it talks about beating RE4 again, as opposed to actually playing Skyward Sword after getting through the introductory part of it, which is a bit like eating the bread off a sandwich and then not the rest of it.
But I hate meat!
Well, there's another slice at the bottom, don't worry.
Yeah, there is, isn't there?
Actually, there's a half loaf at the bottom.
There's Resident Evil Revelations is about to come out in 2 weeks here, and I've already seen some of the early reviews in the magazines and things. And I mean, it's getting great reviews.
Yeah.
People seem to have very favorable views of it compared to Resident Evil 5. Seem to think it's just really interesting, sort of new kind of structure, because it's on a portable. It follows a more episodic kind of format. And they've got like an anime writer or something, or somebody who does TV in Japan in that structure and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, the point is, it seems like they've done some really cool things. You know, it's not just... obviously Johnny talked about Mercenaries, you know, last week. That was just like, let's get a Resident Evil game out on the platform.
Right.
But Revelations is very much not that by the sound of it. It's a really, you know, it's a real Resident Evil game. It stacks up there with the best in the series, but at the same time is actually very deliberately designed for the 3DS for portable. So that sounds great. I mean, I'm looking forward to getting that, even though I'm not a big Resident Evil fan. So I would have thought that could be a good little pick-me-up for Sergeant Foster if he likes RE so much.
I mean, there are games on the 3DS now. Like, they exist. I have played them. The situation is not nearly as dire as it once was.
Right. And as far as Zelda goes, I mean, I think John has his own version of Skyward Sworditis, but for Sergeant Foster, the thing is, it sounds like you got down to the first dungeon and quit playing. And if you are a lifelong fan of Zelda, as I know you are, the dungeons are probably one of your favorite parts, and you haven't actually experienced them yet. So I think you probably quit right when the game was starting to get really good. So go back, even if you have to force yourself to go back, do that, and then it will get very much easier after that, because you'll pick up the momentum and you'll be experiencing the best parts of the game. So, you know, sometimes you have to do that with games. Sometimes I feel like, man, I know that I'm going to love that game if I just get a little bit farther in it, but I really don't want to play it right now. But sometimes I'll just force myself, because once you get to that sweet spot, it just becomes natural after that, and you're having a great time. But, you know, some games are an uneven experience. They're not like movies where they're 2 hours long and you can just kind of, you know, blow through it whether you like it or not in such a short period of time. When a game's 40, 50 hours long like Zelda, there are going to be parts, and we've discussed them at length, that you may not like as much as the other parts. And sometimes you just have to grit your teeth and get through that, because what's on the other side is worth it.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. That was kind of what I experienced. I was moving through pretty briskly, and then I hit the wall when
briskly.
I got to the... Well, I played that game in 3 days.
I know you did, but I'm just saying, I got to the same point as you in 10 hours less time.
Yeah, if I recall, I was about two dungeons ahead of John with like 20 hours left. I'm like, what is going on?
That's not that brisk.
I had gone through the game to a sufficient amount. And then I got to the point where you had to do the kind of collecting...
Silent Realm stuff.
The first collecting quest, yeah. So, and that was just kind of like...
Yeah.
That's where kind of my mind started to wander.
But John, you should go back to that because, again, even if you don't like the Silent Realm...
And you shouldn't.
That part takes about 5 minutes to get through. And then you get a new power, you get a new item, and a new dungeon, and you're right back into it. So, yeah, it's one of those things you just have to have the gumption. And, it, you know, it goes for everything in life, but especially video games, because they are a very long experience. And you just have to have the gumption to get through it and get to the part that you like. So I'm sure everyone's experienced this before, but as you get older... And there's more distractions and there's more reasons to not play games. You get to these points sometimes, and it becomes very easy to just say, "I'm just going to walk away from it," you know.
Yeah, well, I think this also does highlight one of the reasons why some of this padding stuff, I think, is relevant, because some people would say, "Well, if it is 5 minutes, then what's the big deal?" And, you know, that's fair enough. I mean, you know, again, I'm not going to lie. It's, oh, God, you know, those 5 minutes were so bad. It just ruined the game. Or, you know, yeah. Like, but at the same time, if you're not, like, locked in that you're just going to play through this thing and you have got a lot of other entertainment options.
I'm a busy man, damn it.
Free time and all that. Those little roadblocks, they're little roadblocks, but they can be critically marginal.
Absolutely. They can derail you, you know, but you also, I think the skill of knowing how to get back on track with games like this is, you know, as a gamer,
it's a skill that's worth having.
Yeah.
Because I've been there as well plenty of times where, you know, I've got stuck on something and I haven't touched it for a while. And one day I've said, you know what? Let's invest that time to get myself back up to speed. And then you hit pay dirt and it's great. So I mean, it is a bit of an investment, but again, it can be difficult to make given certain constraints.
I would say that developers should and don't always do their best effort to mitigate the number of times you have that experience in their game.
Oh, exactly. Well, but very often they actively put them in because they're worried about, oh, we've got to make it longer. That's the problem. I mean,
they don't want to be but you can avoid those without pulling a Halo or pulling a Modern Warfare 3 where the game was, what, 5 hours? I mean, you don't have to do that.
I mean, it doesn't have to be that, but yeah, I mean, that's why I think, because you've got to think as well now, video gamer demographics are changing, you know. Yeah. I mean, who are you selling to? You're not just going to be selling to kids and this is their one game for 3 months and they want it to last.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I like to say jokingly that RFN is a Nintendo podcast for grown-ups, and I think the stuff that Sergeant Foster's talking about are grown-up problems. You know, they become a little older, a little more jaded, a little more distracted, and if nothing else, you know, if you can't get up the gumption to go back into Skyward Sword, then pick up a Nintendo game that you really love and that you can always jump into and play.
And burn it.
And play some of that and get back.
Sacrifice it to the god.
And get back in the mood and remind yourself why you love Nintendo in the first place. If you can't do that with new Nintendo games, go back and play the old ones that you really love. And I think that will rekindle your love of what these guys do. And it will say, man, I'd like to get more of that. And then maybe you'll give Zelda another shot because there is that stuff is in there. It really is.
Superman 64, you're getting thrown back in.
Blood for the blood god.
Nintendo had nothing to do with that game. But, you know, I mean, but just in a final defense of Skyward Sword, it made all of our top five lists. It made John's, not top five, but his five list. So
exactly. He's really, really good. And that's why I just think it's a shame that, you know, the slow start, the bits here and there, it's got a lot of grit in the wheels that doesn't need to be there.
I think it was the timing of when it came out, right? It was like, because I knew that kind of like, if I didn't finish it now, I knew that I would be getting like Modern Warfare 3 or something like that, where it'd be like, or maybe Uncharted 3, where I knew that I would be able to play through the entire game in like 12 hours, 10 hours, whatever.
Right. And you know, I wonder if there's another thing at play here, a little bit of psychology, and I might have described this before, but I found with Netflix, I like to get the discs still from Netflix. And one thing I found over the years...
Johnny hates technology. Confirmed.
Sometimes, my Blu-ray discs are really anti-technology. One thing I found over the years with Netflix is...
Depends on who you ask.
They send you these discs in these envelopes that are just text. And sometimes that turns me off of watching it because I forget why, you know, I forget the other things that I know about the movie. I forget what it looks like. I forget what the box art looks like. I forget what the poster looks like. And because I lose that aesthetic And now you've boiled the movie down into the barest element. It is this shit on a disc sitting on my thing, and I no longer feel attracted to watch it. And sometimes because of that, I'll leave it sitting there for days and days, and I feel like I don't really feel compelled to go watch it. And then in a moment of insight or whatever, I will go over and stick it in anyway and just say, damn it, let's just get through this. And I start watching it and I fall in love with it and I remember why I put this on my queue in the first place. I think with video games, it happens too, where you start a game, you play it for a little while and you enjoy it, but then for whatever reason, you end up taking a break from it, and it feels like there's this huge wall between you and the game, and the longer it takes, the more effort it takes for you to climb over that wall and to jump back into it. And I know you feel this way, John, and I think all of us do at some point.
Chrono Trigger. Chrono Trigger.
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
Lord.
I had something in my throat there.
But what you find is that...
You had subtlety in your throat there.
What you find is that the wall between you and experiencing that thing really doesn't even exist at all. It's all in your head. And all you have to do is push through it and start and jump back into it. And once you do, it will carry you away.
It's a question of impetus. I mean, at any given moment, you know, with your leisure time, there's any number of different things you could do, and then there's got to be some impetus that drives you towards one particular thing instead of another.
And there's a related word there, Greg, to impetus, and that's impulse. And I think a lot of times we're driven by...
We're getting
by
language whatever, history on this.
I feel like we're driven by whatever's the closest to us, whatever seems the easiest, whatever seems the shortest, you know, whatever will give mm-hmm. us the most satisfaction in the least amount of time. And so we end up choosing to do things that are easy, and yet ultimately we will not enjoy as much as the things that are require a little bit more effort to get into.
It goes back to what James was saying with Animal Crossing about why it would be better having it as a channel.
Right.
Because it's the kind of game where
yes.
even a little negative impetus, you know, in the other direction to not bother to get the disc and put it in could throw you off because, you know, it's not some roller coaster ride of a game or, you know, something that you can complete or anything like that. You know, it's just something you're going to put a little bit of time into. And so removing that friction is a big deal.
Right.
And those are real concerns, whereas what I'm talking about sometimes is really...
It's purely psychological, but still...
Exactly. It's really like the wall is literally in your head, and there's no reason why this
it's
game...
It's the Matrix, the walls.
Why this
head.
Game should be imposing upon you, and yet it does. And I think you just have to get over it.
And to an extent, I think sometimes that almost becomes just sort of this ominous thing. When you look at the box, you go, fuck.
Yeah, exactly. Like Skyrim is like that for me a little bit right now, because there's all this other stuff I want to do. I played 10 hours of Skyrim, and I haven't touched it. And I want to play more of it, but God, you know, it's scary.
I personally, I never have the big buildup of games, usually. But what I basically have is I have a double queue system where there's the games that are literally on the entertainment center, and those are the games I am in the act of playing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the queue on this little table I have that I put my bag on next to the entertainment center, which is the games that still need to be played. And by keeping them right there... Right in front of my door, so please don't come in my house and rob me now. I see these things that I have to knock out. So it keeps me in perspective going, I need to start getting through these because eventually that is going to start to get bigger.
Well, and this is a huge part of John's Lindemann syndrome, because I think having the games up on the shelf, after a while you get used to seeing them on the shelf and it feels like they yep. belong on the shelf.
Out of sight, out of mind.
I'm
baby.
Not even kidding. I'm not joking around.
Oh, yeah.
I've yep. seen your shelves, John. They're very intimidating. I went there. I wanted to pick a game off your shelf to play it, and I was paralyzed. I stood there for like 15 minutes just oogling. I'm not joking.
I sit here for hours, days at a time just staring
I
at the shelf.
I believe it, man.
Well, see, for me, that second queue literally gets in my way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right there where I put my bag, so I have to make sure I don't knock all that shit over when I put my bag down. It is a feedback loop, because I knock that over and go, God damn it! And then I go, oh yeah, I need to play that game.
And everybody has a different way of dealing with this, but you have to find a way to deal with it.
Well, since Sergeant Foster, you know, appreciates the medium of body art, maybe you could have a sort of memento-style...
Oh, my God.
...must play Zelda on it.
Tattoo it on his forehead, because that's all the classic...
Every time
tattoos.
He gets in the shower, he'll be reminded of the fact that he...
John, I swear to God, if you make a suggestion about where you should put this tattoo, I will come kill you.
That's amazing, Greg. Thank you for taking it that far. All right, people, we gotta wrap up this show. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. We had some great emails this week, and we've had a lot of good ones too that we just didn't have time to get to. So thanks everybody. We read them all, trust me. If I don't think we're going to reply, sometimes I'll even answer it directly, but we do appreciate it. The address again is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and you can also go to the show notes for this episode over at the website, and there's a form there you can use to send emails. A lot of people avail themselves of that option, actually. Before we go, I want to announce the winner of Retroactive. Ladies and gentlemen, by one vote, the winner
My
is...
My vote!
Well, it's not any one particular
Mine
vote.
Mine was the last one.
It is. Yeah, James cheated a little bit. But no.
I didn't. I was going to vote for that game anyway. It's not fair to call it cheating.
Why did you wait until the last minute?
Because I forgot.
Wow. It's not like you didn't have any reminders. But yes, so the winner is Fire Emblem, the Sacred Stones. Coming in second place was Wario Land 4, and that will be returning in a second chance poll. Pretty soon it might actually be the next one we do. I'm not sure. And then third place, poor Kirby. It was Kirby and the Amazing Mirror. It's a great game. You should still play it if you're an ambassador. It's still free, right? You still own it, probably. But yes, we will be playing Fire Emblem, and if you want to participate in this Retroactive, it should be fun. It'll be my first Fire Emblem. But it will be the Sacred Stones, and I've heard it's really good.
These stones be sacred, son.
So that's what we're going to play. I hope you will play along with us. There will be a forum thread also linked in the show notes for this episode. Go over there and check it out and discuss the game as you play it through with everyone else. It'd be actually, if you get stuck or if you have questions about the game.
And you will.
It'd be a great place to get information as well. Also, you can leave a review for us on iTunes. If you're a fan of the show, this is like a rite of passage. You're not a true fan until you write an iTunes review, if you have iTunes.
And put the word bros, hoes, and tacos in it.
And radios.
Yep.
No, not radios.
And slob.
Tacos with radios inside, covered in slob. Yes, we would love for you to do that because it helps other people find the show.
So visceral.
We would appreciate it. iTunes is a big driver of people discovering our show, and your reviews make a big difference in that. So please do that if you get a chance. You can also like us on Facebook, and I do post things on Facebook throughout the week. And then on Twitter, I'm at Johnny Metz. John is
Mr. Diamond J.
Mr. Diamond J. James is NWR_James.
The original.
And Greg has so many accounts, I can't even name them all. So just follow one of us and we'll retweet them every now and then. Greg owns Twitter. He's all over it.
He couldn't just be one account. He had to...
Yeah, Greg is too big for one Twitter account.
Yeah, they got him wet, fed him after midnight, whatever.
Where? this podcast, I am very sorry for everyone who's listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the chemistry that can only come from doing this show together for 4 years.
From meth.
So everybody, thanks for listening to us for the last 4 years and to the show for... potentially up to 5.5 or so. We love our listeners and we love doing this show for you, and we hope you enjoy it. And that's all for this week. We'll talk to you next time on Radio Free Nintendo.
Anyone who just got a 3DS for Christmas and hear about the GBA games that they can't have won't understand nor be too happy. Then I may have Skyward Sworditis.
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 Sworditis. It's Latin, Johnny.
Are you saying...
Oh, fuck you, Lindemann.
Are you saying there's no consensus on the correct pronunciation?
If you say it properly now, John, I can take all of that out. I can make it sound perfectly fluid. I'm giving you this chance.
Nope, leave it in. It stays.
John, all that right. Response was amazing. It's Latin.
All right, I'll do it over again.
No.
I'll do it over again.
That's fantastic.